This is August 23rd, 2015, and today I'm going to talk about resilience and Zen practice as a form of resilience training. Let's start with just highlighting a few bits from a Time magazine article. This is dated June 1st of this year. On resilience. The title of the article is Bounce Back. Scientists now know why some people rebound so well from setbacks. And this is by Mandy Oaklander. So I'm just going to kind of hop, skip, and jump for a few points here to set up the whole topic. She begins by talking about the work of Dr. Dennis Charney, 64, who is dean of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. And she talks about kind of punishing, or at least demanding, tasks he would put his kids through. More on that later, about that as resilience training itself. Then she says it's a tantalizing arena for neuroscientists who are getting better at understanding why some people bounce back from difficult experiences, both those they seek out and those that blindside them, while others don't fare quite so well. And thanks to modern imaging, scientists can peer inside the brain in real time to see how and to what extent stressful situations change the structure and functions of the brain. They are also learning that training for resilience can change the brain to, well, make it more resilient. And then she mentions another professor of psychiatry at Yale, School of Medicine, Southwick is his last name, Dr. Stephen Southwick, and she says, much of the new evidence suggests that with a little practice, anyone can develop resilience. I would say Zen practice or any kind of meditation practice. There are lots of ways to intervene so that stress or trauma doesn't derail you, he says. No one size fits all. And then she says, the author, that's good news because humans get stressed far more than they realize. And she gives some examples. The hot and cold boss, the traffic delays, the spat with their spouse, the monthly bills. These are all registered as stress in the brain. And then Dr. Southwick says, the vast majority of us will be faced with one or more major traumatic stressors during a lifetime. But then she says, but the countless smaller stresses also take a toll. And this is what I'll be mostly addressing in this talk. Is the smaller stresses, the daily life stresses, because I doubt that many of us have experienced trauma. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it depends on how you define trauma. But without even getting into what's widely considered a traumatic experience, we can still appreciate the factors that go into resilience. Then she does a little bit of a historical overview. In the 1950s, an Emmy Warner, a developmental psychologist and a pioneer in resilience research, was inching toward an answer as to why some people do better than others. There was a he did what's considered the most or she Emmy don't know what's considered the most important longitudinal study in the field, a 40-year project following nearly 700 children in Kauai, Hawaii, many of whom had alcoholic parents. Her research showed that a third of the most vulnerable children adapted exceedingly well over time. Werner wanted to know what makes a person thrive in the aftermath of adversity. The study found that factors like having a tight-knit community, think Sangha, a stable role model, and a strong belief in their ability to solve problems helped children succeed. And then skipping some more paragraphs here. She talks about how our brain evolved to deal with threats like wolves and saber-toothed tigers and that kind of stress. And then she says, the problem is, even though we're no longer bumping into wolves, we're constantly activating the same neural pathways of fear with everyday stressors, worrying about the future, fretting about the past. This, of course, is one of the most simple ways to make meditation understandable to people. It's a way to refrain from dwelling in the future and in the past, because that's where so much of our stress can accumulate. Thoughts about the future, worrying, or replaying things from the past that upset us. The more we use this neuronal superhighway, the more efficient it grows, and this mode of thinking becomes our default. But new research shows humans can train their brains to build and strengthen different connections that don't reinforce the fear circuit. Over time, if people use this new pathway enough, it can become the new response to stress. Well, that's what happens, as we'll hear just a few minutes. That's what happens through daily meditation. That is the training. Scientists can see how resilient brains respond to emotion differently than those who cling to emotional experiences. She quotes a neuroscientist who says that in his research he has seen differences in the brains of people with anxiety or depression that suggest they have a hard time letting go of emotions and are often too engaged in emotional processes. This is from this Martin Paulus, director of a brain research institute in Oklahoma, who worked with Navy SEALs. And it says the Navy SEALs, on the other hand, weren't glued to the emotional experiences. Why? Paulus says they're more resilient. And then the author says, and just like working your biceps or your abs, training your brain can build up strength in the right places and at the right times, too. Well, that's another way to understand meditation, at least Zen meditation. It's training ourselves in attention, how to direct our attention, how to use our attention and not misuse it, how to use awareness in a conscious, intelligent way. She continues, the author, a good way to gauge how close you are to resilience is to consider how you react when things don't go your way, Davidson says. This is Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. His research shows that the way we cope with little stressors strongly predicts how we'll do once the big stuff hits. Personality is not as big a factor as one might think. Pollyannas are not always more resilient than pessimists, and even stubborn curmudgeons can pick up traits associated with resilience. Skipping a little more here. So far, the author writes, researchers have found that facing the things that scare you relaxes the fear circuitry, making that a good first step in building resilience. Well, here too, this is inevitably what happens if we sit long enough months or years, we will be facing what scares us. We may not at first, we may not have those scary things arise in the mind or in the body, but if we persist long enough and peel back the layers of our defenses structures, our mental defense structures, then we will be looking straight at fears maybe that we haven't even noticed, haven't been conscious of for years, can arise during strong sitting. So this is a given if you persist in Zen practice long enough, that you will be facing your fears. And the rule we have about not moving during a round of formal sitting is a way of just saying, don't flee, don't hang in there, face your fear. And then if you can do that, if you can avoid fleeing, then we see, can come to see through the fear. She continues, they also have found that developing an ethical code to guide daily decisions can help. Well, there you have the precepts. Studies have shown that traits scientists once thought of as nice but unnecessary, like having a strong network of social support, are critical to resilience. Very few highly resilient individuals are strong in and by themselves, Southwick says. You need support. I just heard a few minutes on NPR about these two women who became rangers, very, very elite, rigorous standards of months of training in the most harsh conditions. And one thing that the segment pointed out on the radio was that these women and the men, the male rangers, learned through training to turn to others as when necessary and to help others when necessary. The author says there are even neurobiological elements to social support. When people are exposed to a stressor in a lab, their heart rate and blood pressure don't go up quite as much if a friend is in the room as they do if they're alone. Another encouragement, another reason to sit with others when you can. In an interesting twist, scientists have learned that working the body's muscles makes people's minds more resilient as well. That's because exercise also spurs the development of new neurons, which are quite literally damaged by stress. Over time, regular exercise can tamp down a person's stress response. If there weren't enough reasons to do daily exercise, there's another one. And then she gets into our wheelhouse. The most compelling new research about resilience focuses on mindfulness, an area in which most people would do well to improve, since people spend 47% of their days thinking about things other than what they're actually doing. Mm-hmm. A 2010 Harvard study found that it's got to be more than that. But let's let that stand for now. And she talks about all, you know, mindfulness is everywhere, the benefits of mindfulness. So I'm going to skip over most of that. And just go to the last column here in this article. It's subtitled, The Meditation Miracle? And she says, it might seem too touchy-feely to believe that becoming tougher has everything to do with tuning into the mind, the body, and the present moment. But that's precisely what Richard Davidson from the University of Wisconsin is finding. And it recounts how in about 20 years ago he wrote to the Dalai Lama asking if he could study Buddhist monks to see how meditation changes the structure or function of their brains. And then there's been an awful lot published since then about the amazing benefits of meditation. Davidson has found that consistent practice, notice, consistent practice, changes how the brain looks as well as how it operates. The more experienced the meditator, the more quickly the brain recovers from stress. Another recent study shows that meditation can even help decrease expression of pro-inflammatory genes. This is becoming recognized as increasingly important matter of health and illness is these pro-inflammatory genes, inflammation, to put it more simply. Davidson says, the changes we see aren't just changes during the meditation state itself, but they're changes that persist beyond the meditation state. They transform our baseline. And a solid baseline state is what we really need when the water gets rough, he says. So that's just a once over lightly from the Time magazine article. Now I'm going to turn to the concluding chapter of a new book by Lawrence Gonzalez, who wrote the book Deep Survival. Deep Survival is absolutely riveting book about, well, the subtitle is Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why. And it's about people in extremis who get into accidents in climbing or flying or who does better than others. And this is a follow-up book he wrote called Surviving Survival, The Art and Science of Resilience. And this concluding chapter of the book outlines 12 strategies to adopt to take advantage of the natural systems in the brain, natural systems for resilience. And I'm just going to go through these. Not all of them are have corresponding, not all of them are really that suitable to find correspondences in Zen practice, but most of them do. So number one, this is the way he says it, want it, need it, have it. And this he describes as imagining your ideal self. Now hold on, that doesn't sound like what we want to do in Zen is imagining any kind of self that isn't there in the first place. But we can work with this strategy that he's posing. One way to understand it is in the figure of the Buddha himself or herself. Every Buddhist temple, every Zen temple or monastery I've ever been to has Buddha figures here and there. And as I say at introductory workshops, they're reminders of who we really are. I would say in this case, this is a way to be reminded not just of our ideal self, but our true self. A well-made Buddha figure provides enormous non-verbal information about who we really are. The dignity of the sitting posture, the repose, the serenity of the face, the wonderful groundedness, stability, and balance, the equanimity, the equilibrium of a Buddha figure is all pointing to who we really are in our true nature, our Buddha nature, if you will. So that's our version in Zen of what we can aspire to, which is not something out there apart from us. We want to become what we already are. This is what he might call our ideal self. It's our true self. Number two, be here now. And this is basically mindfulness. This is the second of his strategies. He says that it dispels illusions and makes you flexible. This is, of course, about being present, attentive. This is the very central mission of Zen practice, and arguably many kinds of meditation, not just Zen, is to be present, be aware. I can't resist just, maybe not for the first time in Taisho, just mentioning how I understand the difference between mindfulness as it is articulated in the current craze and Zen meditation. Mindfulness is one of the, what in Buddhism is called one of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the path to self-realization. Mindfulness is number seven out of these eight. Seven and eight are mindfulness and concentration. Mindfulness is the noticing element of meditation. It's when you notice that the mind has wandered. This is hugely important. Mindfulness is hugely important. This is not to diminish mindfulness. I couldn't be happier that more and more people are getting on this bandwagon of mindfulness and seeing how it changes their life. But it's not the whole picture. It's important, noticing things. But the other side of it, the second part, is the concentration, where you have this is the ability to bore into one thing at a time, to hold the mind steadily on one thing without being distracted. And in our daily lives, sometimes mindfulness is more important, such as during driving. And during driving, we need to be aware of what's going on all around us. I sometimes warn people after a 7-day sesshin because we tend to be so concentrated coming out of a 7-day sesshin, that is so focused, there is a slight danger while driving that you're going to not be aware of what's going on the periphery as you're driving, looking in your rear view mirror, your side view mirrors. So concentration has a risk of becoming like tunnel vision, where you shut out everything. But mindfulness without concentration can devolve into a kind of distractedness. So you need both. You need them integrated, mindfulness and concentration. The other thing that I always want to point out are the differences between mindfulness and Zen practice more generally, not just the actual sitting, but more generally. And there are three huge differences, things that I've never heard of in this secular mindfulness that we keep hearing so much about now. First is the emphasis in this secular mindfulness, the emphasis on self-promotion, self-mastery. In a word, the self. Using mindfulness to earn more money, to be more successful, to be more competent. This is great. Why not? Go for it. Who wouldn't want to make more money and be more successful and be more powerful and more competent? But what Zen offers, especially Zen Buddhism, is a much greater vision, which is the Bodhisattva vision of devoting ourselves to this practice for the sake of others, in order to help people, not just to for self-improvement. That's how we end every teisho and every sitting, is a reciting of the four Bodhisattva vows, beginning with all beings without number I vow to liberate. This is one big distinction between the secular mindfulness and Zen Buddhism. A second is the moral element. In what I've read of the secular mindfulness, there's nothing there about, or very little maybe, about the importance of ethics and living an upright life so that you're not hurting other people. And then the third big distinction between secular mindfulness and Zen Buddhism is the vision of enlightenment, of coming, awakening to our true nature, our Buddha nature. I won't spend any more time on this second strategy that he itemizes, mindfulness, because we're talking about it all the time in Teisho. Number three, be patient. And here he adds, surrender control of the outcome and trust the process. It's hard to find many other bits of advice that are more important in Zen practice than surrendering control of the outcome and trusting the process. In fact, that very phrase, trust the process, is something that I could, especially in Sesshin, I could say it every day in the Zendo to remind people. A lot of this comes down to trust. Trusting the process. Trusting the practice to work on its own without thinking that we are at the controls and have some kind of ultimate control over the outcome. What we can control to some extent is our effort. That's different from the outcome. We can push our foot down on the gas or let up. That's something we have some control over. But in the end, the outcome is somewhat out of our hands. And the sooner we can make peace with that, the sooner we can learn to simply trust the process. But it requires patience. We all want instant results. Who wouldn't? But anything of enduring value takes time. It takes time, perseverance, patience, persistence. The wonderful thing is that the more you can get yourself to the mat and sit, the more you will develop patience. It's not like there's some fixed amount that each of us has, and good luck. It's like a muscle, our patience muscle, that we develop on and on. I've said before that either you become more patient in doing zazen, or you quit. But you can't do both. You can't keep practicing and not become more patient. Number four, be tough. Learn to suffer well, he says. He quotes a Richard Tedeschi, a psychiatrist who treats people with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. To achieve the greatest psychological health, some kind of suffering is necessary. This is another law of life, like patience, the importance of patience, that Americans, maybe even more than most other people, resist the importance of pain. Not as something we seek out for its own sake. Who would want that? That would be silly. But as something that you just have to go through in order to develop yourself. And this isn't just in Buddhist wisdom. This is human wisdom. Many people know these words by Nietzsche. What fails to kill me only makes me stronger. One could quarrel with that a little bit, but there's a lot of truth to it. If we have the resources, the inner resources, to endure pain, I don't mean just physical pain, of course, but emotional pain, mental pain, then it will make us stronger. This is how the Time magazine article began, where the author talks about the children of this Dennis Charney, one of the leading researchers in resilience. I'll just race through this for the sake of parents. Dr. Dennis Charney knows that each of his five children has hated him at some point or another, particularly when he dragged them along on one of his semi-dangerous, that's in quotation marks, adventure trips. He recalls a perilous hike with one of his daughters, who was 13 at the time. And this is him speaking. Some weather came in, and there was some wildlife. When she said she despised me, it came like from her soul, says Charney. His son Alex knows the feeling. A decade ago, Charney took him on a kayaking trip to Patagonia with his best friend, that's the Stephen Southwick. It rained the entire time, the life jackets didn't fit, and Alex had to share a broken ruddered boat with his dad for 12-mile runs every day. When it was all over, Alex informed his father he never wanted to speak to him again. but then the author continues, but as a psychiatrist, Charney knows there are benefits to forcing people out of their comfort zone. Resilience is essentially a set of skills as opposed to a disposition or personality. This is important. Resilience is essentially a set of skills, not a disposition or personality type that we're stuck with, that make it possible for people not only to get through hard times, but to thrive during and after them. Just as rubber rebounds after being squeezed or squished, so do resilient people. And so, getting back to Zen, and so we have this certain rigor of our formal sittings, where you're not allowed to move, except if you're in an emergency, of course, that's fine. But if you're not allowed to move, And part of that is social, so that you don't distract the people near you. but it's also so you don't flee. You don't back away from the pain. And just what most of you already know, talk about not just enduring pain for its own sake, but finding sitting at the forward edge of your pain, where, because if you're too comfortable, if you were sitting in a lazy boy chair, Barca lounger, where you had absolutely zero discomfort, your mind would not have the same tautness, and some pain, mild pain, really has great power to concentrate the mind, as long as it's not too much. And then, as far as developing toughness, nothing does that as well in Zen practice as sesshin, these intensive seclusions where we sit 10 or more hours a day. I can hardly imagine a more effective way of developing strength of character. And it's not just military, white-knuckling kind of strength, which isn't the real strength. The real strength is resilience. The real strength is adaptability. That's what meditation develops, not just how much you can clamp down your teeth and endure what's happening, but learning to manage the pain or the, and not just, again, not just physical pain, managing, working with, accommodating yourself to the difficult parts of sitting. Another non-Zen person, Viktor Frankl: what is to give light must endure burning. Hakuin, whose chant and praise of Zazen we recited together about half an hour ago: don't suppose you can attain to the highest without some degree of suffering. People who want to misrepresent Zen can say this is borders on masochism, of just kind of relishing pain for its own sake. This is not true. This is why we provide so many different kinds of cushions, so people can minimize their discomfort while sitting. But almost no one can get away with sitting for long periods without some discomfort, and that we can learn to work with. Under this fourth one, be tough, learning to suffer well, he mentions exercising, eating well, and staying strong and healthy. This is all part of being so-called tough, being strong. Five, get the small picture. And he says, finding one thing each day to possess as your own and feel good about. What might I suggest for that? One thing each day to do, first thing in the morning, last thing at night. Number six, put things in their place. Here, this is more specifically about dealing with trauma. He says, if traumatic memories are encapsulated in a ritual time and place, they are less likely to torment you the rest of the time. So he uses as an example traumatized soldiers from World War II returning to Normandy each day. He uses another example, getting married on the anniversary of your spouse's cancer surgery. He says you create a new set of retrieval cues for those memories, which puts you in charge so that the memories occur when and where you want them. I'll just let this stand on its own because there's no equivalent for Zen practice, except just facing your fears. We already touched on that. Number seven, work, work, work. Staying busy is the most effective means of adapting after trauma. Don't sit around brooding, in other words, he says. But I would say, but do sit. Sitting, if it's at all decent sitting, is non-brooding, because it is non-attachment. It's not, it means not clinging to the past. Brooding is clinging to the past. And work can be also an escape, but it can also be good, as he says. Number eight, see one, do one, teach one. Here by that he means practice the posture of being the rescuer, not the victim. Here too, I think this is more related to traumatic incidents from the past. But the larger point is, having a higher purpose in your efforts can take you out of yourself and make you feel more effective, more in control, more powerful. And this goes back to what we were talking about a little while ago, about yoking your practice to a higher aspiration than just your own benefit, your own self-interest. Nine, touch someone. And by this, he says, he means staying socially connected, having a support system. We mentioned this earlier in the Time article. It would be hard to find a potentially more supportive group than the Sangha. For new people, by Sangha, I mean other members of the Zen Center, other people who are practicing. And that doesn't have to be just the Zen Center. I would say anyone who aspires to grow beyond their own self-interest and to help others. It's hard to overstate the importance of this. In the old texts, old Buddhist texts, they talk about the importance of having a spiritual friend or spiritual friends for support in this practice, which can be so challenging and even discouraging at times. We can't do it alone. 10, be grateful. Above all, avoid self-pity. Well, in this be grateful, here I just want to distinguish. I don't believe there's much point in just deciding that you're going to be more grateful. You may become a little more grateful, but far more effective way of fostering gratitude is to practice Zen every day. Gratitude is one of the richest benefits of sitting. It may take some people longer than others, but if you persevere at this practice, a daily practice, long enough, gratitude will start to flow, and there's nothing I can imagine that is more nourishing and sublime than gratitude. But here's where Zen practice takes an altogether different approach than these 12 strategies. We don't need to strategize in Zen. Everything comes out of the sitting. The practice, not just sitting. I keep saying sitting. I always mean the sitting meditation and the moving meditation. Extending into your daily lives this mind of stabilized awareness. That's the practice. And all of this, you don't have to go about making a project out of becoming more grateful if you're doing daily practice. And the more you do, the the better, the more you're going to find your way into gratitude and becoming socially connected and aspiring to something more than yourself and wanting to work. I'm going backwards in these points. And becoming stronger and more patient and more mindful and so forth. 11, walk the walk. Act as if you're better. I think another version of this I've heard of is fake it, then make it. Here I think of, in terms of Zen practice, I think of how at first, how the practice, and I don't mean just the sitting, but sometimes the devotions, bowing, when you come in the Zendo, bowing, doing prostrations, the rules and so forth, they can seem alien. They can seem, we can feel apart from them. But if we can have enough trust in this ancient tradition to do it even though we're not wholeheartedly behind it, if we can do it, yes, go through the motions, then we grow into these things. And then we come to experience for ourselves, we confirm the wisdom behind these different things. And then number 12, he says, life is deep, shallow up. And here he means humor. And there too, Zen practice, the version of this in Zen practice that you don't have to make a project out of, but that will come naturally, is you through practice, you stop taking yourself so seriously. You stop taking the self so seriously. It happens on its own, there too. We don't have to make it one of 12 strategies. It happens on its own. As we said 45 minutes ago in reciting the Hakuin, upholding the precepts, repentance, and giving, the countless good deeds and the way of right living, all come from Zazen. Daily practice, sitting and moving practice of attention, awareness, presence of mind. Our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.